After other steps, it is fed to a machine for pulling. Each step requires accuracy and precision to make high-quality threats.
The beating heart of this company is the quality control unit. Here, threats are tested for their strength and uniformity based on specifications of its productions. The results are then grouped into three categories based on their quality. The highest grades are then packaged and released into the market. Because of Iran's strategic geographical location, this company easily exports its products to Turkey and competes with other big exporters, such as China and India. This manufacturer's main claim to fame is the high quality of its thread. With such large productions, this company is eyeing the expansion of its production facilities. It has already implemented a second phase of production expansion, and the feasibility study for the third phase is in the works. These developments offer numerous investment opportunities as well. Most of the raw material needed to make polyester threads are domestically produced, with the exception of the spin finishes. The majority of finishes need to be imported. These oils are used because of their properties for increasing thread performance and processability of polyester yarns. These features add value to threads, which makes spin finishes a vital ingredient in the production mix. However, the U.S. imposed sanctions have made importing this item difficult over the years.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
Have you ever purchased a piece of land on Mars? In the so-called metaverse, you can do that. Metaverse is a subcategory of the blockchain technology, where you can practically live in an entirely virtual world. Today, I'll walk you through an Iranian company that has a lot to say in the blockchain industry.
Artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, and blockchain. These are the keywords to unlocking a whole new world called metaverse, where giant tech brands like Facebook have expressed huge interest in. But perhaps blockchain is the top player in the new universe. Accochain is one of a myriad of companies that are working to advance the blockchain technology and its amazing subcategory that's called cryptocurrency.
To step into the blockchain business, you'll need to learn the ABC of the market. Without it, you'd most probably face some serious challenges. But don't worry. This company is here to teach you the A to Z of the market.
When talking about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin is what comes in mind. But a large number of new names other than Bitcoin and Ethereum are emerging on a daily basis. To enter this business, you'll need to attend special courses to analyze the trends of different cryptos. And Accochain has it all.
One of the major projects undertaken by this company was to create crypto trading bots that can help you buy and sell cryptocurrencies at the right time and with peace of mind.
As humans, we get tired. As humans, we go through emotional burdens, which could overcome our reasoning and lead to an irreparable loss in the hard-to-sketch crypto trends. Using Accochain program bots, there's no need to fret about our human deficiencies. The Iranian tech company says it seeks to experience all areas of the blockchain technology. It believes if tapped into, the emerging tech can serve human beings to a great extent and make our lives easier. In fact, the blockchain tech was invented to give rise to the best known crypto, Bitcoin. But today, its applications go beyond digital currencies. This Iranian company says a blockchain stores information electronically in digital format. It can be in the form of games, virtual reality and augmented reality, or any new wild idea, such as metaverse.
The blockchain technology is revolutionizing the way we live, as it easily combines with other high-tech areas, such as IoT, to give rise to new, more complex technologies. In this burgeoning market, in order to survive, companies will need to be innovative and keep tabs on the latest developments. This company says it's already on track.
Well, many thanks for that awesome report. All right then, now let's take a look at some interesting news in the carpet industry, which we may not have been able to fully cover. The Tokyo Olympics was all the hype this summer, and a group of local artists expressed their Summer Games enthusiasm by creating an interactive luxury carpet showcasing the history of the Olympics.
The carpet, named Olympic Atlas, comes alive with augmented reality technology. Using a special application, people can scan the artwork and access related audiovisual information. The carpet designer says the study and the design of the carpet took 8 months. The tapestry carpet uses 250 colors and was weaved by 8 masters from Tabriz in 6 months. The designer also points out that this carpet has its own exclusive NFT, which can be found for auction on the OpenSea website. The artists wanted to highlight handicrafts of Azerbaijan provinces and the enormous capacity of this industry in Iran.
Carpets can be breeding grounds for all sorts of unwanted allergies. Now, an Iranian carpet manufacturer has come up with a know-how to make antibacterial carpets, which have become quite popular.
These carpets use material containing silver nanoparticles. Originally, these carpets were released into the market around 2 years ago, and since then have been exported. In 2019, exports of these carpets amounted to some $2 million. They were mainly sent to neighboring countries, as well as Russia, South Africa, and some in Europe. In a nano dimension, antibacterial effects of silver increases so that they are able to destroy over 600 types of bacterial species. The antimicrobial protection prevents the growth of mold, dust, mites, and other bacteria, which are significant triggers of asthma and allergies.
With that, we wrap up our program for today. On behalf of the entire team of Bazaar, stay safe.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
limelight.
The only solution to the Afghan crisis, exacerbated by the refusal of the U.S. to release several billion dollars of Afghanistan's own funds, even on humanitarian grounds, similar to the economic terrorism of Washington against many countries, is the formation of an inclusive government as soon as possible. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kahan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading All-Inclusive Government, Only Solution to Afghanistan's Problems. Stay tuned for more. Country freshly freed from foreign occupation, and that too from the tentacles of the world's topmost terrorist entity, the U.S., faces a myriad of problems and many years to recover. But if unity is absent and a militia concentrates power in its hands through the barrels of guns at the expense of all other ethnic, religious, and political groups that make that country a nation, then it will be called factional occupation with no guarantee for peace, stability, progress, and survival. This is the sorry state of Afghanistan at present. Since the Taliban that seized power in Kabul earlier this year, or was tacitly handed control by the Americans, seems unwilling to form a broad-based national unity government. This does not augur well for Afghanistan's future and even for the Taliban, which so far, despite the earnest advice of good neighborly Iran and the world countries, has not included any representative from the Tajik, Hazara, Uzbek, and other ethnic groups, as well as from Shia Muslims that make up over a quarter of the country's population. The Taliban are not even willing to share power with fellow Pashto speakers, many of whom do not agree with the ideology of the militant group. As a result, the current rulers of Afghanistan have failed to win political recognition by neighbors eager to help it recover from decades of destruction as well as from most world countries. The only solution to the crisis exacerbated by the refusal of the United States of America to release several billion dollars of Afghanistan's own funds, even on humanitarian grounds, similar to the economic terrorism of Washington against many countries such as the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the formation of an inclusive government as soon as possible. This was the gist of the speech delivered in Islamabad by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian to the 17th Extraordinary Session of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, Council of Foreign Ministers in the Pakistani capital recently. He said, "Sustainable security and political and social stability in Afghanistan are possible only through real collective participation and an inclusive and effective government in which all ethnicities and religious groups play a role." Iran's topmost diplomat noting that the Islamic Republic has over the past 100 days delivered more than 13 humanitarian aid consignments to various cities of Afghanistan pointed out in a brotherly manner to the participants, including the Taliban delegation from Kabul, that any delay in the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan will give the war-torn people's enemies the chance to activate an extensive network of social criminals through spreading the terrorism of Daesh, creating economic hardships and critical conditions in livelihood, healthcare, and basic needs of life. While presenting a four-point solution for resolving the crisis that included the release of Afghanistan's assets in foreign banks, he said, national reconciliation, national cohesion, and inclusive participation in government and governance, alongside the good faith and benevolent contribution of neighboring countries, as well as regional and Muslim states, in the fight against terrorism, insecurity, and instability, in addition to providing humanitarian assistance, are the most urgent requirements for supporting Afghan people and guaranteeing a bright future for them. Hopefully, the friendly advices of Iran and other countries would be heeded in Kabul, and soon an inclusive government would be formed with the participation of all ethnic, religious, and political groups.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
An investigation into the confidential files of the U.S. military has revealed a shocking truth about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed over 1,300 documents from a hidden Pentagon archive. The report has shed more light on how the U.S. undercounted thousands of civilian deaths caused by its deeply flawed intelligence and faulty targeting in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. According to the military's count, over 1,600 civilians, many of them children, have died in U.S. air operations in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. The U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility while destroying the lives of civilians. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group, Air Wars, showed that since 2001, at least 22,600 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as 48,000. The documents show that the U.S. forces conducted more than 50,000 air strikes in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan over a five-year period. The majority of strikes were carried out without prior plans. The report also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. The U.S. military, from the terrorist CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. They simply kill civilians and rarely offer compensation.
The lack of accountability, even in the way in which these crimes are being revealed, shows that this is accepted within the political establishment of the U.S. government today. And it has been, when you look at past wars and the incredible number of civilian casualties.
In its report, the New York Times reviewed cases in which civilians were killed, none of which resulted in an admission of wrongdoing. The report says poor or inadequate surveillance footage often contributed to deadly targeting failures. Most recently, 10 people were killed in a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Washington initially claimed to have targeted terrorists, but later it was revealed that all the victims were civilians, including 7 children. Washington was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. Also, the New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation.
Well, just to say, it's also important to recognize that the only people who've ever been prosecuted for the drone strikes are those who revealed that drone strikes were going on and that they were targeting civilians. I'm speaking about Daniel Hale, now in prison for exposing U.S. civilian strikes, Julian Assange. There's a refusal to hold anyone accountable.
The U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability in various theaters. It also suppresses the leaked information about crimes it committed in those countries. For instance, its efforts to punish the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, who caused Washington great embarrassment by disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen in face of American officials' denial. His case proves that Washington fears its misdeeds being revealed again. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by Israeli settlers in villages around the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank following a shooting near an illegal outpost in Homesh that left one settler dead and two wounded. Dozens of Israeli settlers attacked Qaryut village south of Nablus overnight. The attackers broke into many homes in the town and assaulted local families. Scores of Palestinians were injured in the process and moved to several hospitals in Nablus. According to the Palestinian media, the settlers also blocked the main highway connecting Nablus and Ramallah and attacked vehicles with Palestinian license plates with stones, causing damages to several cars. In reaction to the attacks, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates called on the United Nations to promptly activate the international protection system for Palestinian civilians under Israeli occupation. It also called on the international community to pressure the Israeli regime into stopping acts of terrorism committed by settlers against Palestinians and their communities. The ministry held the regime of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett fully and directly responsible for settler violence and terror, and warned against the dangerous repercussions of their acts on the status of the region. It is stressed that Israeli authorities are encouraging and protecting settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. According to Israeli advocacy group B'Tselem, 2021 saw a rise in settler violence of 28.6% compared to last year. UN human rights experts have expressed alarm at the rising rate of violence directed by Israeli settlers toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, already in the first 10 months of 2021, there have been 410 attacks by settlers against Palestinians. Four Palestinians were killed by settlers this year. Nearly 700,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. All the settlements are illegal under international law, and the United Nations Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. Since occupying the West Bank, Israel has misappropriated more than 200,000 hectares of land there for its own purposes, including building and expanding settlements and paving roads for settlers. Some areas have been taken over by the regime, issuing military orders, others through daily acts of settler violence. These two seemingly unrelated tracks are both forms of state violence. The Israeli apartheid regime and its representatives actively aid and abet the settlers' violence as part of a strategy to cement the takeover of Palestinian land.
The settlers and the uniformed soldiers work together, not without tensions, but they always support each other, and the settlers are used to carry out the particular kinds of attacks, burning trees, certain kinds of terror attacks, which the army prefers not to do. They shoot, they kill, but they protect the settlers 100% of the time. The settlers know this, and it gives them a sense of complete impunity.
Last week, the U.S. Under Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and an Israeli minister who is responsible for police discussed the increase in settler violence against Palestinians. That drew rebukes from pro-settlement ministers and right-wing opposition lawmakers within the Israeli regime. Omer Bar-Lev later pushed back his critics, saying they were having difficulty looking in the mirror and that settler violence has become an issue on the international stage. But Israel's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, jumped in to say it's just a marginal issue. In a tweet on Tuesday, he noted that there are marginal elements in every community, and they should be dealt with using all means. But we must not generalize about an entire community. The Combatants for Peace group, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian victims of violence, condemned Bennett for his Tuesday comments, charging that the Prime Minister had given full backing to depraved settler violence, which has reached new heights under his watch. The group added that Bennett gave a green light to the Wild West atmosphere in the territories. Also, an interview published on Wednesday revealed what Israeli Foreign Minister thinks about this issue. He told an American periodical earlier this month that extremist violence is a stain on Israel amid a noted rise in violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians.
There is a situation in the West Bank which is lawless. You might consider the situation to be one of no legal protection for Palestinians whatsoever.
Bennett's marginalization of the issue was aimed at legitimizing and praising settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. Let's not forget that Israeli soldiers and police usually defend the attackers or simply stand to the side when they assault Palestinians. Therefore, settler violence is a central issue that requires urgent attention from the international community to put an end to it.
Margaret Lillian, Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. They're really there's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats, who are sort of centrist, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North Shropshire.
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does. And of course, I take
so which
personal
bit?
Responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at number 11 Downing Street. He's also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year amid the first nationwide lockdown. The Premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from Conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the Conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
Inflation in the UK has risen to its highest level in 10 years. The cost of living has surged by 5.1% in the 12 months to November, up from 4.2% the month before. This was the steepest increase for a decade and more than doubles the central bank's target. Increase in costs for fuel, energy, clothing, and second-hand cars were indicative of the rise in inflation. Economists had expected an inflation of 4.7% for the month of November, and the Bank of England had projected that inflation would hit 5% in the spring of 2022, before moderating towards its 2% target in late 2023.
We haven't seen inflation at this level for many decades. The highest level I can remember actually was back in the 1970s, when it reached 25%. So 5% is still very high, but nothing near that level. But it's still double the level that the Bank of England expected, of just over 2.5%. And so it's going to be very difficult to try and adjust to it. Now, the question is, of course, is this going to be embedded inflation and carried on, as we saw in the 1970s, or is it just rolled off after 12 months because of individual price increases?
It is believed that global supply chain problems, staff shortages, and rapid demand for oil and gas have all driven up prices. The end of COVID support schemes and Brexit have also played a part. In November, petrol prices jumped to the highest ever recorded, while the cost of used cars jumped due to shortages of new vehicles. The UK fuel poverty has further increased due to the increase in energy costs, putting further strain on the average UK family.
And those supply changes take a long time to work their way through. Most recently we had, for instance, a shortage of lorry drivers, and only now we're beginning to see our way through the other side of that, so it's taken 3 or 4 months to work its way through. Other issues of supply chain will be much longer, as a lot of businesses will try and shorten their supply routes, supply chains, and de-risk their supply chains, and that means more localization, local product production, and maybe less trade coming out of, say, the Far East and other areas like that. So global trade was designed in such a way, it was like an elastic band, very efficient and very taut, but unfortunately when that elastic band breaks, it's very difficult to replace quickly.
The rising inflation has sparked an outcry from Britain's Unite Trade Union. It says many workers face an effective pay cut with the prospect of below-inflation annual wage increases. The Unite Union has urged companies to grant pay hikes that preserve the buying power salary.
Well, what we've seen, obviously, is oil price rising, particularly gas. And unfortunately for the British public, they've got a nasty shock coming in the spring when the government-imposed cap on the gas price is taken off. And a lot of people could see their prices of gas nearly double in value, which is going to be very painful for them indeed. So this is working its way through the system. We're going to see higher wage rises coming through. And this has particularly hit people at the weaker end of society, those who are poorer paid. Well, if nothing else, it means they're going to get paid more. But unfortunately, not in real terms, because even if you get a 4% pay rise, which has been suggested for many, when you've got inflation at over 5%, you're still losing money.
Current estimates suggest that costs for the typical UK family will jump by £1,700 in the year 2022. But Labour claim the government is not doing nearly enough to tackle the problem, especially as further inflationary pressures from rising energy costs are coming down the line. Omicron, which emerged late last month, forced Britain to reimpose coronavirus restrictions that were passed by lawmakers late on Tuesday. The UK economy was already struggling prior to the arrival of Omicron, growing by 0.1% in October from 0.6% in September. The International Monetary Fund warned Tuesday that new COVID-19 variants pose downside risks to the outlook for Britain, urging the government to consider new emergency stimulus measures in the event of fresh lockdowns. The IMF predicted inflation would reach around 5.5% early next year, its highest in 30 years, and warned the bank not to succumb to inaction bias. Economists have warned that the supply chain disruptions will continue to disrupt economic activity, leading to sharp price increases at least through the year 2022. This phenomenon is not unique to just the UK. The US and many other parts of the world are also suffering from inflation, from food prices to energy costs.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The claim that U.S. drones are humane and effective has always been a lie. But by classifying the program as top secret and by aggressively prosecuting whistleblowers, the United States has been able to hide the truth about drones from most Americans. We'll prepare for you an article written by Leonard C. Goodman, a Chicago criminal defense lawyer and co-owner of the newly independent Chicago-based weekly Reader. The piece is titled U.S. Killer Drone Program Stays Afloat on Sea of Lies. The article has been published by the Asia Times. On 29th of August, in the final days of its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, the United States launched a drone strike, firing a 20-pound Hellfire missile at an aid worker named Zamari Ahmadi as he parked his car outside of his home in a residential neighborhood of Kabul, Afghanistan's capital. The strike killed Mr. Ahmadi and 9 members of his family, including 7 children, 5 of whom were younger than 10 years old. The children had come outside to meet Mr. Ahmadi as he returned home from his job at a non-governmental organization where he distributed food to Afghans displaced by the war and occupation. When a surviving member of Mr. Ahmadi's family complained publicly about the errant airstrike, the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, did what it has been doing for the past 20 years in Afghanistan. It simply lied. According to the New York Times, the Pentagon claimed that Mr. Ahmadi was a facilitator for Daesh terrorist group and that his car was packed with explosives, posing an imminent threat to U.S. occupation forces guarding the evacuation at Kabul airport. General Kenneth McKenzie, commander of the U.S. Central Command, claimed the drone strike dealt Daesh terrorists a crushing blow. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called it a righteous strike. When it was confirmed that Afghan children as young as 2 years old had died in the strike, the Pentagon claimed that any civilian deaths resulted from the detonation of explosives inside the vehicle that was targeted. The U.S. military produced the wrong assessment that the occupants of the vehicle were wearing suicide vests and that the car itself was packed with explosives. Most U.S. drone strikes take place in remote areas, and no follow-up investigation is ever conducted. However, the slaughter of Mr. Ahmadi's family took place 3 kilometers from Kabul Airport, at which American reporters were stationed covering the chaotic evacuation of U.S. occupation forces and allies from Kabul Airport. In the days following the deadly drone strike, reporters from the New York Times conducted a thorough investigation, visiting Mr. Ahmadi's home and place of work, viewing video footage from his security cameras, and consulting with weapons experts. This investigation quickly confirmed that every official statement from the Pentagon was false. Mr. Ahmadi did not visit a Daesh safe house on the day of his death. He visited his office. His car was not loaded with explosives. It was loaded with water canisters that he was bringing home to his family because there was a water shortage in his neighborhood. After the publication of the New York Times investigation, the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, conceded that it had made a tragic but honest mistake when it assassinated Mr. Ahmadi and members of his family in a drone strike. No one has been held accountable for a deadly mistake. Targeted drone killing is an innovation of the so-called war on terror. It facilitates continuous war by making it appear less costly and more humane. Indeed, President Biden has already announced that the United States will continue launching drone strikes from afar after its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Similar language was used when President Biden announced an end to American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, while reserving the right to continue killing Yemenis if it believes they are linked to Daesh or Al-Qaeda terrorists. And of course, don't expect any peace dividends from the end of the war in Afghanistan. In September, the U.S. House of Representatives approved, in bipartisan fashion, $778 billion in military spending for 2022, a $37 billion increase over the 2021 military budget. More than half of the funds American taxpayers have sent to the Pentagon since 11th of September 2001, about $8 trillion, has ended up in the pockets of private corporations, such as Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. These companies then use some of those taxpayer dollars to lobby Congress and the President to keep the wars going and the money flowing in into their pockets. The late U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower warned of the danger that a profit-seeking military-industrial complex would produce a state where wars are not fought with an intention of winning them, but to ensure that they never end. British author George Orwell articulated these dangers in his classic novel, 1984, wherein he described continuous war as an opaque, low-intensity conflict whose primary purpose was to siphon off resources and perpetuate itself. Begun under George W. Bush, the drone program was fully embraced and escalated under the presidencies of Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Barack Obama assured Americans that U.S. drones are so exceptionally surgical and precise, narrowly targeted against those who want to kill us, while not putting innocent men, women, and children in danger. The claim that drones are humane and effective has always been a lie. But by classifying the program as top secret and by aggressively prosecuting whistleblowers, the United States has been able to hide the truth from the American public. Ironically, of course, the people targeted by U.S. drone strikes know the truth about who is being killed. Thus, the classification of all information about drones does nothing to protect national security. Rather, it protects government officials from any accountability. I have asked several members of the U.S. Senate about the drone program and have never received a straight answer from them. In the autumn of 2009, I attended a fundraiser for Senator Chuck Schumer at a Chicago law firm. The United States has just suffered one of its deadliest months in Afghanistan, in which more than 50 Americans were killed. Senator Chuck Schumer assured the group that Barack Obama was turning things around with his unmanned killer drone program. I asked Senator Schumer about civilian deaths and whether the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, which then ran the drone program, had ever studied whether drones killed more terrorists than they created. The senator claimed he was pretty sure that the CIA did reach such a conclusion. In fact, as WikiLeaks later revealed, the CIA had conducted such a study in July of 2009. But that study, called CIA Best Practices in Counterinsurgency, reached the opposite conclusion, that the clandestine drone and assassination program was likely to produce counterproductive outcomes, including strengthening the very extremist groups that it was allegedly designed to destroy, particularly if non-combatants are killed in the attacks. This report was classified as secret, meaning it could be read by Senator Chuck Schumer, but not by you or me, until 2014, when WikiLeaks released it to the public. Others have come forward to expose the official lies told about the drone program. In 2014, a former signals intelligence analyst in the U.S. Air Force named Daniel Hale leaked internal documents exposing how, in 1 5-month period in Afghanistan, 90% of the people killed by U.S. drone strikes were not the intended targets. Daniel Hale also disclosed how children in areas targeted by U.S. drones cannot go out and play on clear days because that is when the drones fly. Daniel Hale said that drone operators reported having to kill a part of their conscience to keep doing their job. Hale was prosecuted under the Espionage Act for leaking these documents and has been sentenced to 45 months in prison. The investigation by the New York Times into the drone assassination of Mr. Ahmadi and his family is an important step in bringing some sunlight into the clandestine world of drone warfare. Sadly, most victims of U.S. drone strikes remain anonymous, as the strikes take place in remote areas of faraway countries such as Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. Much of the work to reveal the truth about drones still falls on independent investigative journalists and whistleblowers like Daniel Hale. They are our best hope to begin holding those responsible accountable and bringing an end to this dangerous lie.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Ilam commemoration ceremony.
سبک زندگی اسلامی در رفتار رزمندگان ما و شهدای ما یه چیز برجسته ای است که نمی‌شود از این صرف نظر کرد واقعا.
The Islamic lifestyle seen in the behavior of our soldiers and martyrs is too important to be disregarded. There are so many inspirational points to be seen in the lives of the martyrs that our artists should truly portray an artistic picture of this for the whole world. They should introduce the Iranian soldiers to the world. They should place our soldiers in front of the eyes of the people throughout the world with their great artistic works. Well, the commemoration ceremony that you have organized should open our ears to the message of the martyrs. They tell us the martyrs are rejoicing for those who have not yet joined them, from those left behind them, that they will not have any fear, nor will they grieve. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 170. This path is one that is free from any fear, worry, and concern, because it is the path of God. We should be steadfast on this path and move with strength. We should not falter on this path with the temptations of the enemies.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
ملت ایران با شنیدن پیام شهیدان باید اتحاد خود، اتفاق خود، انگیزه خود، تلاش خود رو بیشتر کنه. پیام شهیدان ما اینه.
The Iranian nation should increase its unity, solidarity, motivation, and efforts when it hears the martyrs' message. This is the message of the martyrs to us. When hearing the message of the martyrs, the officials of the Islamic Republic should feel more responsible towards society and ensure security in the way the martyrs did. Everyone should feel responsible. And all of us should pay attention to this fact that no nation will get anywhere without diligence, struggling in the way of God and enduring hardships. If there are any hardships, enduring those hardships will help the Iranian nation reach the peak. Inshallah, God willing. I hope that God, the Exalted, will bestow success on all of you, that He will grant His mercy and forgiveness to the dear martyrs of Ilam and all the martyrs of the country, that He will associate our magnanimous Imam, who opened this path to us and who brought guidance to the people of the country, with His friends, with the great guides, who have come throughout history, with the prophets and with the imams, alayhim as-salam, and that He will bestow success on you as well. The subjects discussed by the gentlemen, the suggestions and requests they put forward, are primarily related to the executive organizations. These should be submitted to them, but I will ask them to pursue the matter. You too should pursue the matter as well. I will do the same. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The sights and smells of home, from Palestinian traditional clothes to signature Palestinian dishes. Roughly 6 million Palestinians live in exile after 73 years of illegal Israeli occupation, which denies them the right to return.
Events like this bring together Palestinians from all walks of life, but the main target is the younger generation.
It's very important to bring my children to an event like this, to learn more about Palestine, about the struggle of the Palestinian people. Myself, I was born in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. They were born in Britain. They probably have no connection with Palestine whatsoever. So it's very important that we bring our kids to these events to learn more about the struggle of their own people.
The public isn't really educated about the occupation that's going on in Palestine. And they kind of think just because it's going on for so long that it's something that's normal and dismissed. Whereas events like this show us that it's not normal and we should fight for what we believe in.
It can never be just about art and culture. The festival, like the ones before, was also unapologetically political. The organizers called once again on the international community to end the occupation of Palestine. Former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, was there to offer his support as well.
Nobody ever chooses to be a refugee. Nobody ever wants to leave their home, their community, their family, their place of birth, possibly never to return. They don't do it for fun. They do it out of desperation.
We asked Mr. Corbyn about the new Borders and Nationality Bill, which is being described as the most racist legislation in decades and could harm those seeking asylum in the UK.
Oppose the Borders and Nationality Bill. It's brutal, it's unnecessary, and it's demonising people who are desperate. Nobody gets into a boat to cross the English Channel unless they're really desperate. They are desperate people who end up on the shores of this country. They should be supported, they should be housed, they should be welcomed, because they're people fleeing from poverty, from oppression, and from environmental degradation.
The former Labour leader, who represents a growing number of British citizens and politicians that support the Palestinian cause, has been a figurehead of the resistance for decades, bringing hope to young Palestinians who dream of returning to their homeland. Bianca Rahimi, London.